Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Geneva Business Insider for January of 2015. Happy New Year to all of you. And of course, Happy New Year to my co-host, David L. Smith of the Geneva Business Insider. This, of course, is our monthly conversation where we hash out the news and get the views of someone in Europe and someone who has some business connections, who has always some interesting insights into the economy and society and geopolitics. David L. Smith, it is great to have you back here on the Corporate Report. Thank you for joining us again today.
Good to be here, and Happy New Year as well.
You know, I must say I'm a bit perplexed because I was seeing on the White House blog today that apparently there is currently a contingent of Swiss government and businessmen who are in Washington right now visiting Obama, trying to drum up business and support for Switzerland. I'm surprised to not see you included in that list, David. How did they miss you out?
I think I've been disqualified when I was in the States a couple of weeks ago, and my experiences at Miami International Airport were enough to put me off any future trips for a pretty long time.
Interesting. Unfortunately, not surprising. Well, let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. Once again, it is a new year, and unfortunately, not particularly happy news, economically speaking, to talk about. I want to paint a picture here of some of the things that I've noted, even just in the past few days, have been flitting across the headlines. We have iron ore is now down 47% over the past year. We have COMEX copper prices are at the lowest point in 6 years. We have oil down $60 a barrel since June. China's PMI figures have hit their lowest in 18 months. Real wages in Japan have been falling for most of the past 5 years and show no sign of letting up. The UK has just experienced its slowest month of consumer price growth in over a decade. And my favorite, the Eurozone has now hit negative inflation. I think there's a word for that. I think it's deflation, the D word. And I think this is something that we're seeing across the board and is obviously starting to have significant effects on the markets. And we're seeing some really amazing market volatility. I think in the last 24 hours, something like a 940-point swing on the Dow between the high and lows in intraday trading. So we are starting to see some very significant effects playing out from this general deflationary trend that's happening right now. And of course, as always, I mean, all eyes are on the oil price and the way that's playing into the situation economically and geopolitically. This is where we left it off at the end of our last conversation last year, but I think it's important enough that we do consider what is happening right now. David, your take on what is unfolding right now and where you think this is heading in the next few months?
Yeah, well, perhaps we shouldn't have started by saying Happy New Year. I think what we're seeing, as you say, is there's a severe downturn in the economy. And of course, everything is being dressed up to pretend that the economy is going okay, but the realities are there. And oil prices have dropped massively. And there have been all kinds of arguments to say this is a conspiracy to pressurize Russia. But when you see Prince Al-Walid saying that Russia and Saudi Arabia are both in the same boat, one has to say, well, I mean, is he right, or is the U.S. and its friends capable of manipulating an entire world market against the genuine trends? Now, for me, oil at the moment is in a situation where there is overproduction, and for once we're actually seeing markets react in accordance with what one would expect when there is oversupply of something, the price goes down. Same with iron ore, as you say. But I mean, all these are indicators of an extreme malaise in the underlying economy, which people have portrayed up to now as being in recovery mode and everything is doing fine. And the reality is obviously not. Reality is just not there. So is this going to stop anytime soon? I don't see. Once this trend has begun, how it's going to be very easy to stop. And there's so many, if you look as well at all the derivatives contracts, we can constantly talk about the derivatives books with banks. An awful lot of these are linked to commodities and oil and so on. And you're seeing, or will see in the near future, the virtual disappearance of the shale oil business in America in response to this downturn. In Texas are looking at major cutbacks, a major recession. It's also going to impact massively the unemployment statistics in America, because about the only jobs that have been created of any quality have been in the oil sector, and they are now virtual jobs, and these markets turn extremely fast. I knew a guy many years ago who was involved in this one in about 30 years ago in the downturn in America, and in 3 months they went from being a very wealthy family to literally being on the street with nowhere to go, with their mortgage being called, etc., etc. So there is swift retribution for in the US if you're on the wrong side of this. You know, you've been talking about Japan. I mean, all the efforts have been made for years and years and years and years to stop the deflationary trends in Japan. We've been watching Abenomics, which in an earlier interview you and I discussed right at the beginning of it, saying it would end in disaster. And it now looks as though that disaster is very close. And the extraordinary thing is, you know, it is that Abe manages to get reelected to do more, faster, worse.
And believe it or not, his approval rating just went up slightly in the month of January, which I mean, take the poll figures for what they're worth. But yes, I mean, it's absolutely outrageous that the Japanese public would even consider putting up with that. And you raised such important points that maybe we should go over a few of them. Of course, there's an estimated $22 trillion worth of global commodities-based derivatives floating around out there. But those numbers about how the notional worth of these derivatives bets and are impossible to track. So again, we should take those numbers with a grain of salt. But there are trillions and trillions of notional dollars that are on the line with these contracts. And just as an example of how the oil downturn is going to start affecting some banks that may be adversely afflicted by this, there's a report up on Zero Hedge right now that notes that banks including Barclays and Wells Fargo are facing potentially heavy losses on an $850 million loan made to two oil and gas companies, and it looks like they're going to probably end up getting 60 cents on the dollar for those loans, a $340 million loss, and that represents just one loan deal with two oil and gas companies out of the many, many, many such arrangements that exist, and the derivatives bets and all of the other things that are dependent on these figures, these commodities that are now plunging across the board pretty much. So it is, I mean, it is a pretty bleak picture. And as you say, it is going to start affecting the economy in a downwards direction in a lot of different ways, including, of course, in the U.S., where we saw the shale and oil and gas boom driving 20,000, an estimated 20,000 small and medium-sized hydrocarbon operations have sprung up in the last several years to take advantage of this boom. And all of them really are on the line now. Now that we've got oil under $50 a barrel, there is no way that shale is doable at this price point. So yes, it is going to start having significant effects unless there is a giant rebound in the oil price, which doesn't seem likely. And it strikes me, looking at this picture, that there is, from within the system as it exists, I don't think there is a nice way out of this. There's no outcome or ending to this that could possibly be good. It's only a question of whether it will be a short, sharp, painful correction, as they say, or whether it will be a long, drawn-out, deflationary depression-type correction. And I don't see, from the structural side of this, how it could play out differently, unless you have a different take on that.
Mm. Well, I just made one observation. I think that at every market price, there is an equilibrium of winners and losers. So when the price comes down, it kills the American business. But lots of people will be making money by shorting that business anyway. So the investment banks don't really care whether gold is going up or going down or whatever the price is. And what does happen is when the price goes down, is a few hundred thousand or a few million people lose their jobs. But once again, the investment bankers don't care at all about that. And it means that the reserves that do exist in America remain in the ground. Whereas if you look on the other side of the world, you see countries like Russia or Saudi Arabia. And the more the price falls, the more they have to pump, because essentially they want to maintain their tax revenues. So if they drop the price 10% and sell 20% more, then that's fair enough. So what it is, it's a it creates an unbalanced depletion of oil reserves on a global basis. And ultimately, you know, the higher cost producers are on the winning side of that, because if the price comes back up again, then America will simply, you know, wind up their nodding donkeys in Texas and pump out some more oil. So it is, you know, there are winners and losers on it. But the overall short-term trend, I don't see how it can rebound, because for it to rebound, there has to be some major shift in the amount of demand. And of course, the world economy is just not there to provide it. And the speculators who have assumed that the prices remain high have all been burnt and are being forced out of their positions. So I think it's down for now, and it will be down for a good long time. And that will cause grief and pain to a lot of people.
I think you're unfortunately exactly right about that. And I guess the question is, given that this is the situation as it exists, and people do have, hopefully, have some savings or some nest egg out there in their portfolio, what do people do in a deflationary environment to try to protect that wealth?
Well, as I said before, deflation is not all bad. It depends on what personal circumstances you're in. For the real little guy who's living in state housing and sees deflation, it means that his wage check is going to go further. But for anyone who is in a kind of middle situation where he has got his mortgage to pay and all the rest of it, deflation is an extremely nasty experience. Because it's not just the fact that someone's net worth goes down, but if your net worth goes down way below the value of your house, you can no longer sell your house, because you have to, you know, declare bankruptcy at that point. So it paralyzes the real estate market very, very effectively. Most people's balance sheets deteriorate pretty rapidly in those circumstances because of the level of gearing. So that the problem actually is not deflation. Deflation per se is not so terrible. It is the associated debt that caused the problem. And this is bankers, once again, they don't care if there's deflation or inflation. Their problem is what happens to the bank's balance sheet when there is deflation, and how does that hit their clients? And the more debt that you pump into the system, the more severe the reversal is. Because if a guy has got a house where he's got 10% equity and the price drops 20%, he's wiped out. So there's nowhere to go, and we're back to handing keys in. And this deflation is what they basically, when the collapse happened a number of years back, I mean, it was all of the pumping of the money to reblow the bubble was to try and make sure that asset values stayed high enough to make sure that the banks were solvent. And that, of course, pumped wealth into the pockets of the people who were rich in the first place, in order to, you know, to cover the bank's genuine losses. And ultimately, I think we'll end up in a deflationary collapse when the tools used by the central bank to inflate the world economy cease to work. And then you look at how bad will that collapse be, and you say, well, every penny that's on the balance sheets of these banks basically represent unrecorded losses. So it's going to be a pretty horrendous crash when it comes along.
Not a pretty picture. And again, I think it is important to keep in mind this is probably, in a deflationary cycle, is the worst time to be going into long-term debt, like a mortgage or what have you, because precisely as you say, the dollars will go further, but the debt will cost more in the long run. So in fact, strangely enough, sitting even in cash would be relatively better at this stage of the game, as long as the deflationary cycle continues. I guess the point is getting out of that divestment of the portfolio at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, indeed.
Okay, all right. Well, let's leave that there. I'm sure this is a topic we're going to be returning to in various ways throughout the year, so look forward to that in 2015. Let's move to another subject, which also is not necessarily good news. President Obama, for those keeping track at home, just announced his new cybersecurity proposal, which he launched at something called the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center. Very Orwellian in and of itself. And this legislation, for those who haven't read it yet, that basically the fact sheet on the White House blog contains a lot of feel-good, flowery rhetoric about expanding broadband access and of course, Obama's net neutrality plan, because the former cable TV and telecoms lobbyist, who is currently the chief of the FCC, really is working in the best interests of the public that he represents, right? No, I mean, there are obviously problems with that. But unfortunately, this cybersecurity proposal also contains even more worrying talk about basically encouraging companies and allowing companies to share various information on their customers with the DHS and their alphabet soup brethren to try to combat the cyber threat. And wouldn't you know it, lo and behold, we'll pick this up from an article, President Obama's new cybersecurity proposal is already facing skepticism, that says, Obama's proposal comes amid a week of announcements from the administration dealing with data security and more troubling headlines. On Monday, the president announced a plan to combat identity theft and improve student privacy, a speech that was quickly followed by the simultaneous hack of U.S. Central Command's Twitter and YouTube accounts by Islamic State sympathizers. Congress has repeatedly come up short on passing substantial cybersecurity packages. Interesting phrasing there, by the way, but administration officials and advocates of tougher cybersecurity laws see reason for hope this year, as members of both parties have suggested that the Sony hack is a game changer and a reminder that there is room for bipartisan compromise. And of course, that raises the specter of the Sony hack, which was immediately blamed on North Korea and has now quietly been mostly retracted. But hey, who follows the retractions? Let's just follow the headlines. So David Smith, your take on what's happening right now with regards to this and what it portends for the future of, well, programs like this one.
Well, I think the future is pretty clear. There's more and more state control. And what we're seeing in everything that's done by the government is the old marketing axiom of exaggerate the problem and try to provide the solution, or don't let a good problem go to waste. So it is nothing more than that. Everything is, it is an orchestrated game, and the objective is to lull people into the trap of thinking the government can help solve the problem. And here, my goodness me, we've just found the solution. And oh, isn't that so nice? Both parties are going to work together on it. Now, isn't it just, and then they go off peacefully into the sunset, you know, holding hands with the John Wayne music playing in the background, and everything's absolutely wonderful. And, you know, I'm not an expert in the cybersecurity area. My only concern is, as you say, that, you know, programs like ours continue to get aired. But bit by bit, what the objective is to edit out all of these distractions. And the essential thing, the more I think about the operation of the mass media, it is intended for the masses. And the government know that there is an element of the population that they cannot actually intellectually subjugate by pumping out whatever is on CNN or any of the other NBCs and any of these other pathetic excuses for media information sources. So the smarter people listen to, I'd love to say it, you know, programs like this, and no doubt many others, and that is the only outlet that they have now or will have in the future to have access to genuine thought and genuine criticism of what's going on. Now, some of that may be right, some of it may be wrong. I mean, we don't have the monopoly on what is right, but we just have a monopoly on what our views are. But that is undesirable, and it brings you back to the kind of situation of 1984, when it came to the hate, hate, hate sessions. When you got promoted high enough, there was a small group that didn't actually have to participate. Now, I guess the listeners to this program are kind of in that group, in that we promoted ourselves instead of the system allowing us to get there. But I think it's very important to continue, and I know we thought about talking about Charlie Hebdo in a couple of minutes, but that is part of the protest as well. And however propagandized that particular subject has become, it is part of the same thing. It was a release for many French people to have a laugh at their politicians and the state-controlled system, and it should be defended as well.
Yes, it does raise those interesting questions about freedom of speech and what that really means, and whether it's going to be protected by politicians who don't have exactly a healthy track record of promoting that. And I think that is kind of the heart of this, because ultimately these cybersecurity proposals do tend in that direction one way or another. We've heard the idea floated for years now of a driver's license for the internet, and we've even seen the Obama administration trying to put together some sort of federal ID system, identification system for verifying your online presence, basically, which is actually being trialed in various state legislatures, I believe, at this exact moment. So we're trending in that direction, and I think the writing is on the wall. I just want to pick up on something that you noted there, and that I mentioned parenthetically when I was reading that story, and it's this idea that it's interesting these stories are framed as, Congress has come up short on passing cybersecurity packages, or now there's room for members on both sides to work together on these issues. It's always framed in this way that any time government does something, it's good, and if they're not doing something, it's bad, which is the exact inverse of reality. This is very, very common in the American political context right now to read this type of rhetoric. Is that the type of rhetoric that's presented in the Swiss system?
Less so, but it is present. I mean, Switzerland still has its own federal system, and it does pretty much work. And it also, there's division by the fact the country has, three significantly different languages. So the actual ability to target extremely large numbers of people, that doesn't work quite so well, and everyone has their own regional interests, which is exactly how things should be. It doesn't work in the same way. But the UK, which I suppose is my original home country, is pretty much along the same lines as America, and even the same players. People like Rupert Murdoch have control over huge swathes of the British press and the British media. So you just see the exportation of the worst sides of America, and all the political parties just have to kowtow to these greater powers of the media, or try and corrupt them or influence them or be protected by them, depending on the phase of the game that they're in at any particular time. So,
All right, then finally, returning to this issue of freedom of speech and Charlie Hebdo, which you raised the specter of earlier, let's just end on this really remarkable news that's coming out of this. We saw, of course, recently this big rally in support of freedom of speech by all of these political leaders, and now the amazing headlines that France is going to repeal the Gayssot Act, which makes it illegal to question crimes against humanity, and that's being followed by Germany, Austria, all of the European countries that make it illegal in one way or another to raise questions, for example, about the Holocaust, because all of these people care so much about freedom of speech. Oh, wait, sorry, that's completely made up. Of course that's not happening, because freedom of speech only applies in politically convenient situations. And of course what we're seeing right now is hypocrisy on a ridiculous scale that's happening right now. And once again, politicians parading on corpses to further their own political agendas, which tends to be the clash of civilizations narrative, which is now being, I think, kicked into high gear by the events in Paris over the past couple of weeks. And of course, one of the best examples of this is a new op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from our old friend Joe Lieberman, who is now saying, basically, yes, we must turn this into a global war on radical Islam. In other words, fire up the engines on the F-16s or what have you, and let's get to bombing brown people on the other side of the world, which of course was always, I think, the intention for any event like this. They're going to kick it into high gear. So, David, your take on what we've seen unfolding and what's happening right now in Europe generally as a result of this?
Well, I think I watched the TV program with all the leaders holding arms, and I thought of the Selma marches with Martin Luther King, and how the two had absolutely nothing in common. If you actually look on the other side of these, arm holding, teddy bear hugging, there I'm talking about Mrs. Merkel, obviously, group of people and you actually turned the cameras round, you would have seen thousands of security officers, millions of cameras, streets blocked and closed for miles around. I know exactly where it is in Berlin. It's right beside the Brandenburg Gate. In fact, my daughter's about to go and work at the hotel that was just on the corner of that street, so I know it particularly well. You know, it's in the middle of embassy land. You've got the British Embassy, you've got the American Embassy, you've got the French Embassy, you've got a couple of the very classy hotels. And there they are, with the proletariat, showing solidarity, holding arms. I just had to stretch out for my paper tissue and wipe my eyes. It was so, I was so emotionally touched by this spontaneous outburst of support. And I have to say, there must be a major problem in the security mechanisms in the airport at Charles de Gaulle in Paris, because it would appear that Mr. Netanyahu turned up at this uninvited, and the entire French security system was unable to prevent this Middle Eastern terrorist from getting onto the front line of this group of fairly pathetic people. So if anything, for me, watching that, it destroyed, you know, the very tragedy that is behind this, that, you know, Charlie Hebdo is part of, you know, the French anti-establishment, and the people who are doing it have been brave people. They certainly risked their lives, they've had their offices burned, they've lived under threat for years, and Charlie Hebdo began at the time of President de Gaulle, so it's been around for, goodness me, almost 50 years. And for it to end up with these people being massacred, it is really very, very, very tragic. And, you know, in the UK we have, you know, France also has another publication called the Canard Enchaîné, which is a kind of protest as well against the French political elites in particular and their acolytes. And Charlie Hebdo would go and target things like radical Islam. But, I mean, that was not the center of what they were actually about. They were about, you know, attacking the contradictions and abuses and exploitation of the people by an uncaring French elite. And that's essential of it. So I support it to that extent. And I hope that they will continue doing it, and hopefully without the sickening, as you say, crawling over dead bodies game that's being played by the politicians.
Well, I'm sure you've just unleashed a torrent, a firestorm of controversy over even saying things of that sort. And there's a lot to be said about that. I mean, even with regards to Charlie Hebdo, I think it isn't the same organization that it was when it began. There was a change in editorial leadership and in ownership that in recent years that I think has changed its direction and made it more into a more of a Zionist type entity than it was before. So I think there are questions about that. And regardless, I think for me, the point isn't that I agree with anything or everything or any bit or any particular thing that they did or didn't say or do. The point is, if you are for freedom of speech, you are for freedom of speech, whether it's people making fun of Islam or people making fun of Judaism or any other religion or any other thing in under the sun. It does not mean you support what they are saying. It means you support their right to say it. And of course, that is the fundamental hypocrisy that we're not going to see reflected in the "We Are Charlies" of the politician class. But let's talk for a moment then, just finally here, about the inflamed tensions that obviously events like this cause. Again, regardless of what actually happened with this event or who was actually behind it, which I think there are still some obvious questions about. But obviously, this does touch on a very raw nerve for a lot of Europeans, including in Switzerland. Tell us about the sort of the reaction that people are having in terms of the way this feeds into that clash of civilizations narrative.
Well, it's not, that's not such an easy question to answer. I think, from, you know, the part of Switzerland I live in is very, very closely linked to France. It's French-speaking, and if there is no orientation anywhere outside the country, it's to what's happening in Paris, apart from people who are in international business and so on. So this is a major event, and it's a kind of, you know, Charlie Hebdo's the kind of thing that people here on the fringes would be reading as well. But we're watching, you know, an anti-Islam movement. Then we're seeing, you know, the other event where you know, there were killings in a Jewish kosher supermarket store, and obviously all of these things once again are being rolled out as, you know, we have to act. But I mean, it is, they're just priming the same old pumps to come out with the same old thing, you know. So you have Marine Le Pen, who's kind of right wing anti-immigration people in person in the French political scene, who's using this as an opportunity to say, "I told you so." The Jewish lobby are saying, you know, here we are, we're being targeted yet again, poor us. So it is just it's the same old, I think, in terms of reactions. And it's all completely predictable. And then, of course, you ask the terrible question of who's actually behind all of this. And you see people such as Erdogan, who's the president of Turkey, saying this smells of Mossad intervention, you know, and Secret Service intervention. There's nothing uncoordinated about it. And then, of course, there's a great scandal of what a terrible thing for him to say. But, you know, is it the truth? I don't know. But, I mean, it certainly... There are lots of arguments that could say that would make imminent sense. So I think we'll continue to see. I mean, these are all kind of mini 9/11s, which are just, you know, used to, you know, keep the pot warm and keep stirring the same old things over: anti-Islam, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, all of these things are just bubbling under the surface, and politicians love it.
Exactly right, and we've had the Madrid bombings and 7/7 and all of these events that crop up time and again, just as you say, to keep the pot warm, if not boiling. And, well, it's just a question of where we're going to go from here and what this is going to mean militarily. And if the Liebermans and their like get the way, this really will result in more warfare and bloodshed, which is only going to profit the political class. And I do use the word profit advisedly there. So, of course, we will keep abreast of those developments and keep on top of them here. So long as we do have a free and open internet to come to people to report on these things from an independent perspective. Once again, tell people about your website and how they could find it.
Yeah, my website, the Geneva Business Insider. I run a small independent financial consulting firm. I do not give investment advice, although I do regularly get people asking me for it. So if there's anything you find interesting about this program, I'm always happy to have an exchange of ideas. And if you see any reason to contact me for business, likewise. Thank you.
All right. We'll leave it there, David L. Smith. Thank you for your time. Looking forward to it again next month.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, James.